Hello, welcome to About Regional. My name's Ian Campbell. I'm just back from Nimitabelle, where I caught up with Howard Charles and John Alcock. For the first time in many, many summers, Nimitabelle has water security. More on that shortly. But first, Keith Dance served two terms on Yorubadella Shire Council. Now, given people's experience at the recent local government election, he's calling for change in how we vote at that local level. He believes the system encourages too many candidates to stand and makes it impossible for voters like you and I to make sense of it all.
Look, the voting process, I've argued against the council election style for quite a number of years. Even when I was in council, I argued that we need to change it, and we had set process to change it. The only way it'll change is, one, the council as a whole, the representative body, go to government and say, we think this system should change. We had 55 candidates this time. My argument's always been, we have 8 vacancies. We should have 8 primary votes, and we should be able to, as a voter, to elect our council, not elect one of a group and hope that their preference trail will go where you think it should, or want it to go. If you could do that, we would shrink the field down, because we would only have people who are fair dinkum about being elected. It makes it hard for people to decipher, to work out what their credentials are, and even to know whether these people want to be or are fair dinkum to be elected.
Keith, you talk about candidates being fair dinkum, candidates who actually want to be on council. And after speaking to some of those candidates, the 55 in the Yorubadella and the 26 in the Bega Valley, some of them had no intention of being on council. What role do they play by standing?
Okay, to explain it simply, the group voting that's in Yorubadella, not so in the Bergershire, but in Yorubadella, works on people's laziness. What they want is you to vote above the line, because you can tick it, you don't have to think about it, you tick the number one above the line. And you can follow the group's preference. For example, the Community Voice had 3 groups in the Yorubadella election, and they transferred their preferences 1, 2, and 3 between the groups, hoping that they could build the numbers to get that number, the head of that group, elected. And they knew that the chances of getting the number one elected was better if they could do that. People do not vote below the line, and I've run several elections where I've implored people to vote below the line. Make your choice, and I still vote below the line, because I make my choice of what candidates I want to pick. If we got rid of the grouping system, we would then vote for the vacancies there, and we should have 8 primary votes for 8 vacancies in Yorubadella, for example. And each vote would count as a 1, and then it would be counted simply as first past the post. The 8 councillors with the highest vote numbers are elected, as simple as that. And we should follow Victoria's example, where it's all postal voting. The information is sent out to the elector, and they return it as a postal vote. We do not have to run the gauntlet of going into the polling booth with umpteen people in front of you, shoving paper in your face saying, vote for me, vote for me, vote for me. It frustrates the hell out of people, and people are intimidated by it. Especially, you watch some of the older people coming in, and they are absolutely intimidated by people, and they put their head down, take a handful of paper and go in, and I don't know how they vote. But we had, what, nearly 12% informal voting?
Yeah.
Well, 12% informal voting is one candidate elected. That's a quota. It just doesn't work.
Keith, tell us a bit more about Victoria and how they do it. One of the things that I picked up was that people who really wanted to make an informed vote and find out about all these candidates had trouble doing that. But in Victoria, it sounds like each voter gets information about each candidate posted to them with their ballot paper.
That's correct. They get a brief outline of the candidate, because that's an option to go in with the election material. And there's still, the candidates can postal send out postal information as well. You can still have your placards and that around the place. But the candidate in Victoria is sent to you with a brief outline of who the candidates are, if they choose to put it up there. And then they return it as a postal vote. It makes the whole counting procedure so much quicker and simpler. Like if you go back this time, Ian, there was a huge number of candidates had no phone number or contact details on it. There was only a handful out of the 55 that had a contact detail that you could ring them up or email them to ask them a question. So it just shows you that they're not fair dinkum.
Do you think we run the risk of people being elected to council who don't want to be there? People who really only put their hand up to direct preferences to the main candidate?
I think so, and I think this election has shown that. There's, how do I put this? There's a couple of candidates who were elected. They were supposed to be further down the list. Unfortunately for them, I think they got elected. Now they have to work out whether they can actually fulfil the commitment of an elected councillor, which, Mark, I used to spend 3 or 4 days a week.
Maruya's Keith Dance, advocating for change. Head to the About Regional website for links and to read more information. And head to the About Regional Facebook page to take a look at a really smart conversation that's been unfolding. Some really informed people hopping into this, offering a view. And just to offer a different view to the one you've heard from Keith Dance, a comment here from Pete Wild on Facebook. Pete writes, "Preferential voting is extremely valuable for democracy. It means that people can vote for a candidate that might not have a high chance of being elected and still have confidence that their vote will count at full value if and when the candidate is excluded. The first-past-the-post system would mean that many votes would not count. Like Keith, I too was appalled at the lack of information presented by most candidates at the recent local government election." Thanks for your thoughts, Pete. As I say, head to the About Regional website or Facebook page for more info. This is About Regional, a program that looks to showcase the knowledge, colour and issues of people and communities in southeast New South Wales. Thanks for tuning in. The Archibald Prize is coming to the Bega Regional Gallery early next year. We'll find out more shortly with Ian Dawson, the Art Gallery Director. Nimitabelle is going into its first summer in a long, long time with water security locked away. Level 6 water restrictions have been a constant for the town, described as the driest in southeast New South Wales. But the town now boasts a $5.3 million dam. The 320 megalitre Lake Wallace Dam was officially opened just last week by the New South Wales Agriculture Minister, Niall Blair. I've just spent a cold, windy morning in Nimitabelle with two of the local campaigners, two of the fathers of the Lake Wallace Dam, Howard Charles and John Alcock, who were keen to jump the fence and show me around.
It is so good, and the town is really responding here. It really think the new businesses coming into town. We've now got a business that sells all over Australia on the internet already in town, and there'll be more because we've got NBN in town too. A huge response. Mm-hmm.
This all started 11 years ago for you guys. It's been a long journey.
Yes, that's right, Ian. I guess that it's probably even longer than that. I had cattle on the block next door, and I was riding around there, and it was in the midst of the 10-year drought, and there was all sorts of springs still out through the bush, and I noticed what a magnificent big catchment area, and Howard and I thought, well, this is the place for the dam, so that's where it stemmed from about 11 years ago. Thought it'd be a bit over that.
The idea to build this dam, the need to build this dam, came from a long period, a long dry spell for Nimitabelle. John, when we were talking before, you mentioned the McLachlan River drying up and a long series of droughts.
The 50s were wet and the early 60s. Then in 1967, there was a dreadful drought, and of course the river dried up through that period of time, but of course there wasn't as many people, I guess, in Nimitabelle, and there wasn't a demand on the water. But as the years went on, the years continued to be dry, and even though we got a few wet ones in between, there was a number of dry ones, and Nimitabelle really ran into trouble. It was in the early 80s that you know, we really started to look to, for alternatives.
Howard, give us a sense of the stress those dry times put on your community. How did you see those dry times playing out in Nimitabel and the stress it put on people?
I've actually got some really interesting press cuttings that I've kept. People just saying the families were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't even allowed to have showers when the restrictions were at their height. They were literally, they would take a bucket of water and they'd be used it in the bath, and quite a few of them would have to use it, and then they'd take it out and put it on the plants in the garden. So they had no gardens because they'd all die out. And it was a really stressful time, and people were leaving town because of it.
What about on the land, people running sheep trying to make money out of the land? What sort of stress did it put on those businesses?
Well, droughts were a huge stress on businesses, on farming businesses anyway. So that was a big issue, and then having enough water is certainly on some places a huge issue, and that's the reason we put our dam in, to secure our water, and it's done that. But also, the health of the river was another issue.
Yeah, right.
And so when we got this concept going, we got huge support from people like the CMA, the Catchment Management Authority, and other water, because they could see that through this, not only are we going to solve Nimitabel's problem, but we're also going to solve the problem of the health of the river.
The river you speak of is the McLachlan River. You both know that river really well. What does that river look like at its best? For those who can't get access to the McLachlan River, what does that river look like at its best?
Well, it's a blue ribbon trout stream, and fly fishermen come from all over Australia to fish on it. They love it, and that's always been part of Nimitabel's history and part of its industry, with the hotel and the motel. Always had, and it looks magnificent.
Platypus?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, yes, lots of platypus.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the connection between this dam and the health of the river. Help us understand that connection. Why is this dam so important to the health of the river?
It's really important because what the dam does, it doesn't supply direct to Nimitabel.
Mm-hmm.
Nimitabel pumps from the river, but when the river's too low, then all we do is just let the water flow out of this dam, Lake Wallace, and down into the river and supplement the flow in the river.
It's pretty simple. There's no network of pipes here. You just let the dam flow into the river, as you say, and the infrastructure that's there will pick up that water, pump it into Nimitabel.
And I also think that as it trickles down, or flows down, the old natural water course that the Pickering Creek used to flow down, it gives it a natural cleansing action.
Mm-hmm.
So it's beneficial in both ways.
John, you mentioned before that this is a natural dam site. What do you mean by that? Why is this a good place for water?
Well, Ian, the two hills, as you can see in front of us there, come in quite close together, so it's a beautiful natural site to be able to put a dam. You haven't got a huge big wall, but it's got a tremendous catchment area, so it's got a 10 square kilometre catchment area to catch the water, and even though it's I think it's about a 13 metre wall, so the dam, the water's quite deep at the wall, and if you go up the other end of the dam, it's equally as deep.
Right.
So it's a beautiful natural spot. So what you see down the front of the dam is only a part of it, because it runs back a long, long way, back up to the tree line, and so it's just a beautiful natural sight.
Not long after the dam wall went in, there was a big dump of rain, and of course our skies feed this dam, but I understand there are springs in the ground that also feed this dam, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. In that 10 square kilometre catchment area, there's numerous springs. And even though it's a dry creek bed, now that this dam's keyed in, you'll find that there'll be a flow of water will come in there, and it'll keep the water nice and fresh and clean at all times. So, you know, it's going to be really terrific. And the other thing, Ian, too, that it could be really beneficial in time for if we get fires in the area, for putting out fires with a dam of that size.
You can see the helicopter and its bucket scooping down, getting some water.
You sure can.
You guys are keen to see this dam more than just water storage. You'd love to see people enjoying this space.
Well, look, I mean, it'd be just a tremendous recreational area and a tremendous boost for Nimitabel, because, you know, people are going to drop in here and enjoy the recreational area, and, of course, go into Nimitabelle or Bemboka, and what a tremendous place for fishing. I mean, Howard made the point there earlier on. We've got, you know, it's blue ribbon fishing area, and this lake would be just the most perfect trout lake you could ever wish to find.
Howard Charles and John Alcock from the Nimitabelle Advancement Group. Now, the name Lake Wallace Dam, where does that come from? Well, Wallace with a family that owned the farm that the dam now sits on. And both Howard and John were keen to recognise Bill and Andrea Wallace for their efforts, for their support in making the dam happen and securing Nimitabelle's water supply into the future. This is About Regional with Ian Campbell, and spring is certainly here in the southeast of New South Wales. I'm not sure if you can hear it or not, but there's a blowfly I just can't shake. Hopefully you can't hear it. Hopefully it's not too off-putting. Australia's biggest and richest art prize has just wrapped up in Sydney at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, the Archibald Prize. If you missed it, and I know lots of regional people like to drop in on the Archibald when they're in Sydney, but if you missed it, don't worry, it's about to hit the road. It's coming to the Bega Valley Regional Art Gallery for a couple of months from March next year. Bega Valley Regional Gallery Director Ian Dawson was in Sydney a few months ago to hear Louise Hearman proclaim the winner of the 2016 Archibald Prize for her portrait of cultural icon Barry Humphreys.
Look, it wasn't my pick, and I think Louise Hearman is an incredible artist. I've always really enjoyed her work. I think we can kind of move on from representing people who have been such titans of the Australian arts and culture industry. Let's look at some new, fresh talent that's coming through. That's my opinion. I think it's a bit of a safe choice. There was a lot of beautiful, beautiful paintings there that could have easily been the winner, but I find that with the Shirley Hannon National Portrait Award as well. If I had to pick a winner, I just don't think I really could. And so that's why I'm really glad that we get guest judges in each year to be able to do that hard work for me.
Do you think the subject counts for a lot in terms of winning? I mean, Barry Humphreys, I can't think of a bigger name in Australian arts and culture. Does his presence on the canvas help Louise Hearman win it?
I suppose so. He's been represented many, many, many times in the Archibald Prize, so I don't know what's really pushed them over this year. I thought there was, you know, Louise is a kind of mid-career artist who's doing very, very well. But at the same time, there were many kind of senior artists there that possibly could have got the nod this year, like Amanth Tillers. Look, it's as I've said to you off air, it's regarded as a bit of a chook raffle in a lot of ways. So the winner, it comes down to the kind of zeitgeist of the times, I suppose.
Louise Hearman, in accepting the $100,000 that she won for being the Archibald winner, said something interesting, that it would, I guess, help her remain viable, help her continue to make a living out of art in Australia. And someone of her level, it took me by surprise. I guess the perception is that artists live on the smell of an oily rag. Is that an accurate way to describe an artistic life?
Look, I think it can be. I think it can be a lot of things, having an artistic life. I mean, some of the most successful people I've known have been artists, and, you know, they live very, very comfortably, but they also work very, very hard. So I think it can be said of any profession, really. Look, I think the romantic notion of artists living in a garret and slowly starving is kind of one that's really, you know, slowly disappearing. I think it's really recognised that people have to be incredibly professional. They have to run their artistic practice like a business. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's incredibly important to kind of be across, you know, all those kind of things that go with running a business, marketing, working really hard, you know, doing all the things that any small business owner would do. Look, I find it surprising that someone like Louise would be dependent on awards. She sells very, very well. You know, younger artists obviously do it tough initially until they kind of break through and find that commercial representation. But I think it's possible, and it's something that, you know, people working in the kind of regional galleries or with, you know, down here we have Southeast Arts in their kind of capacity as the regional arts development body. You know, we're there to kind of help young artists and regional artists, you know, go through those harder patches so they can get to a point where their practice is viable.
That sounds like a strength to me in terms of being an artist in a regional setting, to have that close connection with an arts body like Southeast Arts, or have a connection with someone like yourself. Does that make art in a regional area more viable?
Look, I think it has its pros and cons, like everything. I mean, the pros are that it's a lot cheaper to live in a regional area. You've got access to an incredible environment, I think, particularly if you're living in our area. So that kind of makes things a lot easier for artists. I think it's harder to establish those networks. It's virtually impossible. You really have to kind of get into those networks within metropolitan regions to find commercial representation, etc., etc. There are ways of doing it. It's about being strategic about doing it. I'm kind of really thrilled that in the last week I've been notified that an artist who lives in the area that I'm mentoring has got commercial representation at a Melbourne gallery, which I'm incredibly excited about, and she'll be having an exhibition there in 2018. So it is possible. I think we can definitely help with those things, but again, it's a lot of self-motivation and kind of getting out there and not being afraid to put yourself on the line.
Ian Dawson, director of the Bega Valley Regional Gallery, home of the Shirley Hannon National Portrait Award, which happens every couple of years. The Archibald will be in Bega between the 24th of March and the 13th of May next year. If you're travelling, you might also be able to catch up with the Archibald tour at Ballarat, Wagga, Cowra, Hawkesbury and Dubbo over the next few months. There's that blowy again. Can you hear him? This is About Regional with Ian Campbell. Thanks for your interest. Leave you with the Kamaruka Bush Orchestra. My blowy will fit right in. These guys always put on a great show. They played Saturday night at Maruya Showground, a fundraiser for the Southeast Harvest Festival, which is coming up towards the end of March, early April next year, put on by the Sage Farmers Market, a celebration of local produce and the people who grow it. About Regional will be there. The Kamaruka Bush Orchestra with Mike Martin out front calling the dance. Always a great night. You work up quite a sweat. Keep an eye out for their next gig, the Kamaruka Bush Orchestra. Your feedback, contributions and ideas are always really welcome, and this program is available for sponsorship. We can get in touch a few different ways. Firstly, the website. All my contact details are there, and you can dig a bit deeper into some of the stories you've heard in today's program. Go to www.aboutregional.com.au. My email address, hello@aboutregional.com.au, or we can connect via Facebook. Just search About Regional. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks' time when we'll wrap up truffle season with a chef from Bemboka and a really powerful conversation with journalist Tim Elliott about his book Farewell to the Father, a memoir of love and madness, an inspiring conversation in the midst of Mental Health Month. Look after yourself. We'll talk again soon.